organizers, and this is a really exciting topic. I'm excited by each of the talks here. Okay, so so this is our work. Actually, it's been a while, and the paper is still on the archive, and we're still waiting for the referees to return to the editor to review
the first round.
The referee,
right? The first round or the second round?
Second or third.
This round, you may want to complain about the times.
Anyway, so this work is done by our former student, Dichelle, in collaboration with Jerenchi, a postdoc, and Dennis Cardi, professor at Vermont, University of Vermont. And they, so here's the topic. And first of all, I will tell you the review, right? The polarization as a viral phase has been known for quite a while. And then what's new is that the polarization can be also taken as a transcendence field. If you want to study the polarization used by inhomogeneity in your system. Okay, and I give a concrete example that gives rise to a fractional charge in a ferroelectric vortex. So the polarization is, of course, as old as the physics, the topic. And it's a basic materials property of dielectrics. It's used, as we understand now, right? It's mainly as a tool to keep track of the movement of bound charges, okay? And it is autopilot for ferroelectricity, and it characterizes piezoelectric effects and so on. Okay. And now, with the discovery of topological insulators, it's actually, it turns out, also as something that characterizes these insulators as well. And they traditionally is defined as the density of the electrical dipoles. Okay. And it's certainly still in the textbooks. Okay, you think of insulators as a collection of dipoles, okay? And the sum total of that gives you the polarization. But this is problematic when such a dipoles cannot be identified. For example, in crystals, right? We cannot really associate. Even in insulator, we cannot associate the electrons to be bound to a particular site, right? And so this is and also, if you try to calculate polarization from the charge distribution in unicell, this actually doesn't make any sense, right? Because the result will depend on how you choose the unicell. And the modern definitions really, right, use it not as a way to keep track of the bound charges, but actually keep track of the movement of charges in a process, right? And in an insulator, okay, in an insulator we still have this continuity equation, okay. And here we want to represent the charge density by the divergence of polarization. And by this relationship, we can obtain a formula for the polarization as the integral of the transient current. And this is up to a divergence-free vector field. Okay. So J is the transient current density during a process, right, characterized by change in the control parameter lambda. Okay, in this talk, I use lambda for the parameter. And experimentally, and only the change in polarization that is ever measured, okay, And so polarization is defined only relative to a reference state, for example, the initial state of your process.
So that P there, that's a delta P.
Yeah, this is a really bad P. Yeah. So if you say your initial P is zero, then this would be the P.
Okay. And then the lambda there, what parameter should I think of that as being?
For example, you want to squeeze your sample, okay? Maybe you want to move some of the atoms relative to some of the others. Yeah.
Yes. So if you have a P, we have electric field, right? So why? So when you have an iPhone, you have magnetic field.
So here we keep the condition of the average field is actually zero.
But it has distribution, so why only the change of P is measurable? If you have P is non-zero, I can imagine you have this kind of field. That's a physical.
If you consider the chunk of material as a whole,
yes.
Right? Yeah, it's certainly you can define it. Okay. The trouble occurs when you try to define polarization as a bulk quantity. Or define the total polarization in a multiple connected piece of material. Okay. Then you have trouble.
But there also isn't it true that you can get it well defined up to some periodic.
Yeah, I'll come to that. Okay. And the adiabatic current was first formulated by Thales quite a while ago. And he found that the adiabatic current in crystal can be expressed as a integral of the Weber curvature in the momentum time plane. Okay. And then Vanderbilt, Kingsmith and Vanderbilt, so 10 years later, they integrate that current. Okay, and they use a particular gauge for the block function, and they turn into this bare phase formula. Okay, the gauge condition is that the wave function should be periodic over the Guido zone.
So there is this formula right even in the spin orbital coupling considered?
This spin orbital coupling. And they actually did a lot of first principle calculations based on this formula. And so it becomes industry in the first principle.
So what is the final and the initial? What does this mean?
So this is delta P is equal to this thing evaluated at the final state minus this thing evaluated to the initial.
Yeah, first the block function, so you have a final set of block functions.
Yeah. Right. So the beginning of the process, the end of the process.
So there should be delta P and there should be some integration over some parameter or that integration is done?
It's already done, yeah. The Burr curvature has been integrated over the time period, and that's it becomes a so-called two-point formula. Okay, so our challenge is to derive a formula for polarization in a homogeneous material, okay? And we were motivated by the hype on the multi-fluidic systems, right? And people found that the spiral phase of magnetization can actually give rise to a polarization, for example. Right? And some materials, the pitch of the spiral is actually pretty small, and so you can think this is a slowly varying, okay? And the theoretical difficulty, of course, you no longer have the translational symmetry, and so we do not have well-defined block states, okay? And we're lost, okay? So however, if the homogeneity is a slowly varying space, and then we can invoke local approximation. And then we can do something local, like grading expansion. So rescue is to do the local analysis, and it turns out that the several classical formalism that we developed earlier, it becomes just perfectly suitable for this task. The result is that the polarization in response to a homogeneous field can be expressed as something, it's like a Bauer phase, except it's a high order, okay? To transcend this form, a three-dimensional parameter space.
Abelian or non-abelian?
Non-abelian.
So you have greatness dominance.
Here we didn't, so for polarization actually, that doesn't really matter. Okay, so some people call the Bauer phase formula a true silence one form, okay, and this is the true silence three form. Okay. And then, later, actually, happily found that there's a bonus of this, a happy bonus that and there's a connection to the state of vacuum constant in topological insulators. Okay, and
so you're going to calculate the polarization due to the inhomogeneous magnetic order.
Uh-huh. So let me quickly review the seven classical formalism. And here, so you have some parameter, right, that changes slowly over space. And we simply just call it order parameter. So it can be some other control parameter. And the electrons, regarding electrons, is something small, right, a wave packet that moves in this background. Okay. So what we do is expand the packet in the block function basis of the local Hamiltonian, okay, and then find the several cluster dynamics of the packet center, and from that we can calculate currents and everything, okay. And the crystal motion has this form, okay, and if you ignore all these omegas, that's something familiar, right? and the velocity is simply the k derivative of the energy, and the k dot is given by the positional derivative of the energy. So nothing particular. But we found that in general, and the position and momentum are not really canonical variables, okay? And therefore, there's all kinds of Bauer curvature terms appear, okay? This Bauer curvature term in the k-space, right? We have been talking about this associated with, the quantum Hall Chern number is basically the integral of this thing over the k-space. And there are also real space Chern numbers that's equivalent to a magnetic field. Okay, then some cross terms. Okay, and the actual terms that's actually proportional to the rate of change for the control parameter. Okay, so this lambda and the m, there are two sorts of kind of parameters. One is the thing that controls the process. Okay, lambda. The other one is gives me homogeneity. There are two different things.
So I have a Hamiltonian which is parameterized by seven. And so they're like three k's, three positions, and lambda. So it's a function of seven.
Seven variables.
So lambda is a two-node parameter in the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
And what does it physically correspond to?
For example, as I say, if you squeeze your crystal. So this one actually corresponds to the adiabatic pump thing that Stalas discussed. Okay, if you integrate this over time, you get Vanderbilt Kingsmith formula. And this is so k lambda is a kind of a hot current, right? And there's also a term called R lambda. It's actually giving rise to a kind of a force. Right? If you have a bell curvature, right, in a position in the lambda space that gives you some kind of EMF. Recently we worked on a domain wall motion induced EMF based on this time. And this, please remember this, okay, this is like a force, that's like a current. So adiabatic current, this is the force, adiabatic force. Alright? And this A is our, this omega is defined as the curl of this gauge potential, the gauge potential is defined in this way. Okay, this R is the derivative with respect to the slowly varying variable position, okay? So it's straight the outer parameter.
In space?
In space, yeah. And they, okay, so what's this? Now we can just integrate the adiabatic current to find the polarization. And the in the presence of the inhomogeneity, and it turns out that you cannot simply integrate the it turns out that there's a modification of the density states. Okay. Again, because the position and the momentum of the wave packet sensor is no longer canonical, right? And so the density space is not simply 1 over 2 pi to the d power. Okay, you have a correction to the this is Bose terms. Okay, and if you want, you can actually regard h bar as with the Planck constant as a bare curvature between position and momentum. So this is something addition.
Okay.
So in a homogeneous system that vanishes, but then how quickly does the potential have to change or things have to change to be meaningful?
Well, since we're going to calculate the polarization to first order in gradient expansion, so this actually is the meaningful. This is the first order correction. Okay. Anyway, so we have a formula for R, and dot, and we have a formula for the V, and then we can plug it in, and then all these terms appear. Okay. And however, the first line, actually, after a while, we can actually show that it vanishes. Okay. These are equilibrium currents in the absence of external drive. And these are the adiabatic currents that are proportional to the rate of change of this control parameter lambda dot. Okay. And we're considering insulators, so this is K integrals over the zero zone. And so it is this type of terms that give rise to polarization.
Okay. Capital T, that's the period that you change?
Yeah, that's the period. Okay, the terms that proportional to lambda dot, there are two kinds. The one is that it does not involve special derivatives. Okay, any time you have R in this expression, it involves first order derivative with respect to position. And so this is a zero order in homogeneity, and this is the first order in homogeneity.
So if you just consider a homogeneous case, is this formula go back to the...
Right. So the formula go back to the zero order, well, just the Kingsmith Mandelbrot formula. Okay, and that, as I said, if you choose a particular gauge for the wave functions, becomes the integral of the connection, very connection, vector potential over the Brillouin zone. Some people call that Chern's one form. Chern's one form. Okay. Okay, to first order in the homogeneity, and then we have this. Okay.
And then you have. Look here.
Yeah.
If you use summation convention, namely when you.
So beta means sum over beta. And it looks complicated, but you can actually make sense of it out of it. Okay. Remember. So let's look at this term here. And this R lambda is actually an adiabatic force. Okay. If you have a force, I said it's the KK, it's like the Burke curvature in K space, that gives rise to a Hall conductivity. Okay. If you have a force, you have a Hall conductivity that gives you a current. Okay.
All right, it's a pumping force.
So pumping force. And through the Hall conductivity gives you an adiabatic current. Okay. And in this term, so the omega k lambda in the alpha direction, we're looking at the polarization in the alpha direction. Okay. And that's directly a current in the in the direction for measuring the polarization. So that should be counted. Okay. And the zeroth order term has already been taken before, but here's a correction. This correction is because of the change of the density of states, okay, due to the inhomogeneity. So a band, that's in the homogeneous case, the density of states is such that you get the original one. In the inhomogeneous case, the density of states, the density of the electrons per in the full band actually changed. So that's correction on that. And this one is something we actually do not have a good understanding of it. So this again is a pumping current, but in the opposite direction, right? So the adiabatic the process gives you a current, say in the y direction, somehow through this thing that turns into a current in the x direction, where you look at your polarization. And these three curves give rise to this, all together give rise to the second churn form. Okay. And if you integrate this over a four-dimensional space, this actually, if the space is closed, this should be quantized. That's the second churn number. Okay. So what this means that so the K space is already closed, right? And say you have a three dimensional K space, okay. The Brillouin zone, you integrate the full Brillouin zone, and that's closed space. Now if you are pumping parameter, right, returns to make a cycle, and then this is really a four-dimensional closed integral of the second term form that should be quantized.
But again, is this abelian or non-abelian?
These omegas are non-abelian.
So you only have you multiply for actually break time reversal, right?
Yeah. So for charge pumping, it turns out it doesn't really matter if you use abelian or non-abelian. It is because yes.
So this P, to first order this P, that's space dependent, right? Spatial.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, like, I'm trying to think about, like, when you tune this parameter through a circle, and it's quantized, but yet this quantity is space dependent. So I'm just wondering how to think about it.
So that means that if it's not trivial, that give you the same constant actually over space. I'm sorry, actually. Actually, because of one of the variables R, actually, you need to, So here is only two Ks, so it's, You need also integrate over R, like it's the total.
Total.
Average.
So could you, so let's suppose you only have a single band.
Yeah.
Then everything has to be abelian, right? Uh-huh. So would you not have these terms if you just had a single occupied band? Do you need
these? So these are abelian. I mean, the second term number doesn't mean it's not abelian. Yeah.
Do you need more than one band? If you just have one occupied band, could you have a non?
If your universe is just one band, you start your Hamiltonian with one band, it's all the dimensions. If you start your, I don't know, what's the minimal requirement for this not to vanish?
I guess Charlie's question is, if you have one occupied band, but the Hamiltonian may have multiple.
Then
what?
Can be non-zero.
Yeah. Sure.
Now what?
But the second, okay, but it cannot be theta then, right?
Let's come back to, I will mention some models, but let's,
I have a very basic question. I'm not sure I understand the notation. Why do some of your omegas, they have different numbers of subscripts.
Yeah, so this is a k beta, r k in the beta direction, r in the beta direction.
What's alpha and beta?
But why do you say
alpha beta is this directional indices.
Alpha. So alpha is, there are three alphas.
Three alphas.
Then what does it mean? That's the second, there's only one second. This is a vector.
So this is a vector. Sorry. You have to integrate over. So the term number is for each direction. Okay. For each. So if you have a three dimensional crystal, right? You have 3k. Okay. For each. Simplest is considered two dimensional crystals. Okay. And then you integrate over the two-dimensional Plato zone, and they make a special average, okay, say over the period of the spiral, okay, and then over the period of the pumping, then that's a Chern number.
For two dimensions, you cannot possibly get a Chern number because you're
not being. Two dimensions plus a special, plus the space average.
So you have
4D space and 2D real
space. Oh, then there's no lambda. Then you have five parameters, right?
No, the
2K, 2I.
The other K is, you have two-dimensional space, two-dimensional Brillouin zone,
yeah.
Plus average over one direction of the, say the spiral. Okay, so that's three dimensions, right? Then plus lambda, that's four dimensions.
It's slightly in 3D, you define Hawkman, and that is defining a 2D.
So, does that mean that the inhomogeneity is only in one direction?
Yeah.
So what if it?
If it's in the other directions, you just keep summing now. Right? And then it's not a simple Chern number. All right. Okay. So here's the heavy bonus came from. Okay. In our study, we were thinking of a real control other parameters. Okay. And what if you just have a magnetic field? You apply magnetic field, which is homogeneous, but the magnetic field enters the Hamiltonian only through the vector potential, which is inhomogeneous. Okay. So if you treat vector potential in Hamiltonian as inhomogeneity, they just formally do it, okay, and then you get this result. Okay. The reason is that the vector potential is not the magnetic field is indicated by little a. Okay. And that enters only in a combination of k plus ea, right? And so the positional derivative becomes k derivative, and then multiplied with positional derivative of the little x. That actually is a magnetic field. So that magnetic field appears here. Okay. Then the rest become k derivatives only, right? And this is being so this is the result of insulin. more in the battlefields.
The new way of citing people.
I'm not sure they like it, but I cannot help it. The lifelong doesn't work.
There's a one-to-one correspondence between this Latin and the Greek.
I ask you, so Lawrence seems to know, right? to get a non-zero value, there's some minimal requirements on your model, for example. We actually try some models and it's always give us zero, so that we came to this conclusion. And we want to have non-zero polarization first order in the gradient polar parameter, then we have this requirement. Okay. The dimension of the system must be 2 or higher, okay? Otherwise you cannot support 2Ks, right? And the order parameter must have 2 or more components. Okay. And so magnetization actually, so you cannot just simply have a magnetization that's fixed in one direction. Collinear magnetization never give you anything. And the dimension of the Hamiltonian matrix must be 3 or higher. Okay. So if you start with a model of a 2-band Hamiltonian, you try to calculate this thing, it always vanishes. Okay. So this is 3 dimensional Chern Simons form, and you need a large enough support to get you a non-zero result. And then
you need that order parameter here.
That's the homogeneity that gives rise to the homogeneity. So it does not need to be order parameter, it's a lack of a good description. And so we need to say call the order parameter. Yeah. So in the example, right, the magnetic field induced polarization, we treat the vector potential actually as homogeneity. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's not auto problem. Okay. Yeah. And in the minimal model, actually we can deduce the form of the polarization, and it has to be this form, and that's actually consistent with what people found. And so for lack of time, probably I will not. So this is another model. We calculated actually a 4-band model. And so the interesting point that if you can make a vortex, ferroelectric vertex, actually support a fractional charge. I don't want to burden you with the details. I mean, here is the summary, and so the zeroth order expression for the polarization is a surface, in the Burr phase expression for polarization, there's always an uncertainty, right? And it's an integer that's actually given by the Chern number. Okay. In the Chern Simons form expression, there's also an uncertainty of a quantum that's given by the second Chern number. Okay. And
both of those can correspond to adding one electron at the end.
Yeah, exactly. So that's all.
So if you have your multi-furrow, so it's say it's spiral with some long but commensurate edge.
Yeah.
Then you related the polarization that you get when you turn the magnetization on with the second second turn form. But if I viewed it as one big huge unit cell.
Yeah.
Then it's just like the thallus.
Yeah.
So it's the first.
So
there's some connection between the two.
Yeah, Vanderbilt actually, they did the calculation with Obama from that point of view. Uh-huh. It treats this big period as one unit cell, okay? Use their formula. Yeah, you get, they get a result that's proportional. Yeah, the result is proportional to the spiral pitch. And there's, I don't know if there's direct comparison with this.
But there must be some mapping between the formulation.
Their result looks reasonable from our point of view as well.
So how big is the polarization you can get? Do you have an estimation for causing the contribution?
Okay, if we can, we believe Vanderbilt's calculation for actually pretty small. I don't remember, it's much smaller than the ionic contribution. So here, the polarization is just purely from the electronic degree freedom. But the ions can shift. Actually, real materials like it's much bigger contribution.
So for topological insulator, you get charge 1/2 per lambda area.
Charge 1/2, oh, you mean this one?
Yeah. So we discussed quite a few of these in our paper. Yeah, so for a topological insulator, you can use a topological magnetic electric field. And the quantity is such that when you apply a magnetic field, you get E over 2 per lambda area.
Okay. Here's an example that actually this model has it's a 5-parameter full band model, and the it's gamma matrices, okay, and the scalar parameters nx and ny, okay, and then there's another control parameter delta. So delta m's, it control the size of the gap, okay. If you make vertex in the m, and you get a charge, it's given by like this formula, and it's a quantized in half integer units. It's regarding this correction. Okay. If you so then you plot it as function of delta over m, until when delta vanishes, it's
what is the meaning of delta?
Delta is a delta is the third component of this thing that's called turbo proportional to gamma 3. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You called it as a certain quantum.
A certain quantum, and why there's a certain quantum, okay? The control parameter, right, may go from A to B directly, mm-hmm. or actually make several turns mm-hmm. into B. Okay. And if you just use a two-point formula, you cannot make it distinguish if there's several turns in the middle. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there's this uncertain quantum. This always involves a certain quantum in this two-point formula of polarization. And
so in the fractional case, that means your modular and integral multiple of that certain quantum.
Yeah. If for polarization in crystal, that's not a problem because that's just a modulo to the lattice constant. And by the way, this uncertain quantum, actually, all those uncertain, but if you use the transformation form, the integral of that in the action, mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter because e to the I is 2 pi, doesn't make a difference. That's why people can use all those to get dependent, right, in this sense. Mm-hmm. But if you put the upstairs in the exponents, it doesn't make a difference. Okay, that's my understanding why it appears in the actions. Okay. And another note I want to make is that this transform to Gauss is just discovered first time. Long time ago. Gauss.
Transform
3-4? Yeah, transform 3-4. It's called A dot B. Okay. The value field is the vector. It's the integral, strict dimensional integral of that actually counts the number of linkings of the magnetic flux lines.
That's called abelian case.
Yeah. Abelian case, that's a
right.
So, Gauss knew it a long time ago.
Is there any other questions?
Maybe you can explain the picture. Is that lightning?
Oh, it's lightning hitting on.
Genius.
Afternoon. My name's Ying Ran. I would like to thank the organizer to allow me to talk about my work. I think my main contribution into this topological insulator field is that I figure out this dislocation in a 3D topological insulator can have a line node. Today I'm going to talk about something different. So I want to talk about the application of topological insulator physics in a strongly correlated system. So this is not related to the free fermion topological insulator. This is a really strongly correlated context. So what is our motivation? So our motivation is, for example, high TC superconductor. So this is a famous phase diagram of a high TC superconductor. So if you look at it, I think maybe the most interesting thing you notice is the interplay of magnetism and the superconductivity. And in this region, there's something called the pseudo-gap phase, where obviously you see some non-Fermi liquid behavior. So it suggests there's maybe some quantum critical problem here. So when you change the doping, maybe you go from one side to one phase to the other through a quantum critical point. So motivated by this interplay, one can ask some simple questions. So the first simple question you can ask is that in principle possible? So can we have a direct second order transition between a magnetic phase and a superconductor phase? So this is highly non-trivial, actually. So if you think about it, based on this Landau-Ginzburg paradigm, if you have a continuous transition, you basically disorder one order. And if you have a two-ordered phase, basically you can't have a direct transition. You have to go through two transitions or a single first-order transition. So what we found is actually we find such a direct transition. It's between an anti-Fermion order and a DBS superconductor with double unit cell square lattice. So after we find that, we can ask some further questions. So a natural further question you can ask is, are there a systematical way to predict such transitions? Essentially, I want to understand, suppose I'm given a magnet, magnetic insulator. So I want to ask myself, what is the superconductivity close to that magnetic order? By close, I mean there's a transition. That transition means at the transition point, you have something very funny going on. It have a very strong magnetic fluctuation. You also have very strong superconductivity fluctuation. So if we can do that, it's actually very cool. It tells us a lot about this strongly correlated system, the interplay between these two order phases. So in fact, we find such a theory which can do this systematical prediction. It turned out that in this theory, a major ingredient is this quantum spin Hall physics. So that's why I want to say the application of quantum spin Hall physics in a strongly correlated system. So here I just want to briefly outline, suppose I want to predict such a DL transition, what I really need to do. So the general procedure to predict such a magnetic superconductor transition is actually pretty simple. So what you do is, firstly, you have a model, you have some lattice. The issue you want to understand is what is magnetic order, what is superconductor order, and which can be linked together. So what you actually do is you first write down a quantum spin Hall insulator state. Basically, you have some hopping and some spin orbital coupling through some SZ direction. So it's an insulator. So this guy is going to give you a ground state wave function basically to fill up all the level below energy gap. So this guy is not magnetic. It don't break time reversal. It also don't break spin rotation. So there has spin rotation symmetry along the SZ direction. So then, to know the magnetic order side, so what you do is you do the Gauss-Wheeler projection on this wave function. Gauss-Wheeler projection basically is to remove all the bubble occupancy side and all the empty sides. So it enforces a one Fermion per side constraint. So basically, it converts this electronic wave function into a spin wave function. So now you only have spin degree of freedom.
Why the time reversal symmetry is?
Yeah, it's highly non-trivial, but it is. So I will let you know how this happens. So it turned out that even although this guy have a spin rotation symmetry and time reversal symmetry, this other projection you get some magnetic order phase.
And yeah, what did you lose on quantum spin Hall physics because of the T breaking?
Yes, you do lose all of them. It's a regular magnet. The regular magnet.
Projection itself is a time reversal invariant, right?
No, I mean it's a fluctuation.
It's a fluctuation. Yeah, I can let me go over. Just trust me at this moment. okay. So this guy determined the magnetic order side. So to understand what is the superconductor side, what you need to do is, roughly speaking, you just do some simple replacement. You replace the fermionic operator here by the physical electron operator. And this replacement, in fact, it breaks the particle conservation. So you know that after the replacement, you get some superconductor. You have some parity. So this guy is going to transform this Hamiltonian into a superconductor called Hamiltonian.
So if you do just a partial projection, you still get the magnetic order?
Yeah.
With partial projection, you shouldn't have another inverse projector with partial projection. So you can add that if you go to the to the previous ground state. I mean, if you do it. Well.
If you do the partial, I mean, yeah, I haven't thought about this, but that's a good question. Let's go on. okay, so I told you this general procedure. Let's apply this weird procedure on a square lattice to see what happens. So the first thing you do is you write down some quantum spin Hall Hamiltonian. So this guy actually have a flux through the plaquettes on the square lattice. The flux actually staggered. It's a positive here, negative there. And you also have this diagonal hopping, which depends on spin. And this guy is essentially have Chen number plus one for upspin, Chen number minus one for downspin. And then you do the Gauss-Riemann projection. Then you will find that the wave function actually give you a regular in-plane nail order. Okay. So then let's do the first, the third step. You do this replacement of operators. Then you find that you go into this superconductor phase. You have pairing on the bound, which is positive, negative. The point is, this superconductor actually break translation. It also break time reversal, but don't break the combination. So it's something similar to any Feynman order phase. Any Feynman order phase, you break time reversal, break translation, but don't break the combination.
What is the pairing symmetry here? D plus I, D?
Yeah, I mean, let me specify it in a sharp way. So I already lose, because actually this guy doubled the unit cell, the breaking of translation. So you no longer have rotation symmetry along the side, around the side. But you still have rotation symmetry around the Plaquette center. So if you do that, you find the D wave. So that's the precise meaning of D wave.
Why is translational symmetry broken?
Okay, sorry. So the diagonal bound is... maybe I should move it a little bit. So the diagonal bound is positive here and the negative there, basically. Yeah. Okay.
So in the quantum spin Hall state, it's totally gap. So
yes.
If you calculate any Korean function, it's gap. And in the near state, I mean, because quantum spin Hall state can have a Z conservation, so in the near state, you should have a Gauss norm.
Yeah, that's right.
So the projection changed.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So this is actually strong. Projection means really strong interaction.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So I told you a weird procedure, and I told you the result on square lattice. So if I only say this, nobody gonna believe me. But if I really try to convince someone, I need to do a careful numerical simulation. But let's step back a little bit. So let's ask some simple question. Can this scenario pass some consistent check? Whether the theory is even self-consistent? Okay. So actually, I will show you this weird procedure, weird prediction, pass a very non-trivial consistent check. So let's do this check. So how does a continuous transition occur? So suppose you have this tuning some coupling, you go from any Feynman order phase to a superconductor order phase. You have a single transition point. And let's look at the transition actually in that direction. So what you're actually condensing is this magnetic this spin, basically. And your continuous spin, degree of freedom, at the same time, you want to destroy the superconductor. So what it really means is just that the superconductor defect will carry spin. That's it. Okay. So basically, the superconductor water is going to carry spin. But if you think about it a little bit further, you'll find you must have two types of superconductor voltages. One carry up spin, one carry down spin. So the reason is, if you only have one vortex with up spin, for example, if that condense, it's not really a spin superfluid. Basically, this guy is a non-local guy. It also carries volatility. So you don't couple to the external probe as a simple spin degree of freedom. So what you really need is a local spin degree of freedom. However, if you have two of them, you can simply construct this a local spin degree of freedom. So this guy destroy a down vortex, create up vortex, and don't change the volatility, but the flip spin. Right? So that means you have these two guys condensed, you really have a local spin degree of freedom condensed. Okay.
So can I understand in another way that this V up and V down carries spin one half, whereas
one half.
On the Feynman side, the spin wave excitation carries spin one. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. That's a correspondence. Yeah.
But is the vortex core magnetically ordered?
Yeah, you can say so. It means, but it's a short range physics.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not very different from SO5 picture on the vortex. You just combine the two other parameters, and whenever in the hole is displayed.
The anaframe order is only XY order, right? So basically, yeah. You know, I mean, the largest symmetry I get is like 04 instead of 05.
Yeah, it's a similar idea.
I think the difference is in his case, this vortex core should carry some fixed quantum number of spin.
Yeah, so let me keep going, and I will maybe discuss this with you in a moment. So
there is one more question, sir.
Yeah, sure.
So these two quantiparticle states, I can either fill them or leave one of them vacant.
Yeah. If you do that, that's going to be a usual vortex.
And that can also condense.
Yeah, and then you go to some regular insulator.
So I have other possibilities.
You have other possibilities, exactly. So what I'm saying is you have these two vortices, and if you require some symmetry, let's say reflection, and this guy is a translation together with time reversal. So this guy actually flipped the vorticity. This guy not only flipped vorticity, also changed speed, flipped speed. Okay. So if I have two of them, that means these two guys have to be degenerate. Okay. And if you think about it, the only way that these two guys can be degenerate is there's this 2-0 node inside the vortex core.
Do these vortices repel each other, attract each other, or do they interact?
The vortex repel, anti-vortex attract. Yeah.
These are just two different species of vortices?
Yeah, two different species of vortices, exactly. So, okay, basically I'm predicting that my weird procedure, if I work inside the vortex of the superconductor side, I'm going to see these zero modes. So let's see whether...
The vortex of the XY order of M doesn't carry charge?
Yeah, that's going to carry charge. I'm going to come to that in a moment. So let's check whether this guy carry the zero modes. So in fact, we do both analytic and numerical calculation. We found this local modes. It actually carries spin, as we predicted. And you can do something further, right? So we know that this tunneling, this tunneling from down to up vortices is basically the filling of these two local fermion modes. And this guy carries spin plus one. And that's going to be the order parameter here. So basically, that means if I do this local mode here, and I study the symmetry of this guy, I should be able to tell is the antiferromagnetic on the other side.
It's a tunneling from vertex to anti-vertex.
No, vortex down to vortex up. Yeah, the same. What is the same, but the speed flip.
It's not like a single vortex condensed. It's like a particle pair of vortex or something.
It's just simply the tunneling. Okay. Yeah, so we check that. If you check that, it's really antiferromagnetic. These are the numerical results. These are not schematic. Basically, the length is the magnitude of this amplitude, which can tell the magnetization, basically. And the direction is the sign. So this is actually pretty cool. So I start from the weird procedure, but finally I have something I can check, and some highly non-trivial check. And in fact, as Tsenga pointed out, you can do this thing over here. You can ask, how can I understand the transition from this side? So the vortex here must carry electric charge. And if you, let's say, we require particle symmetry for the moment, then you see the only thing that can happen is there are two zero modes that carry the electric charge. So depending on how you fill them, you have these two vortices. And in fact, you can even ask further questions. So the operator which condense would be the operator to fill these two zero modes, right? And this is a queer pair, basically. If I study the symmetry of this guy, I should be able to tell on the other side it's a D wave. So I studied the symmetry by simply computing this matrix element. It's really D wave, right?
This is all at half filling?
Yeah, half filling, yeah.
What is the meaning of your coupling?
Bandwidth. It's a basically Hubbard U, yeah. Okay. So, So I told you there's a weird procedure which pass highly non-trivial check. Basically, I can predict. Basically, I can predict inside a vortex core. Basically, I can predict a magnetic order whose core carry zero mode, and I can even predict the parent symmetry of this mode. I can also predict the magnetic order inside the superconductor core. Okay, so now I want to explain a little bit where the magic comes from. So why I have this weird procedure. So this is called the slave brother theory. The beauty of this theory is it gets everything in one shot. The vortex carry, I mean, zero modes on the superconductor side, zero modes in the magnetic side, and there's a symmetry and so on. I carry everything in one shot. So the idea is you simply split electron operator into a fermionic spin-on and some bosonic charge-on. And people actually do this quite often in strongly correlated context. But then you actually enlarge the Hilbert space. So when you glue them back, you have to introduce some gauge fluctuation. It turned out that the Lorentz theory always be some spin-on and charge-on and some U1 gauge field.
Can you explain this model in the TPM model? This is for Hubbard model, not for TGM model, right?
Yeah, Hubbard model, yeah.
You
see,
it
looks
like this
SV2
gauge theory, that matrix.
Yeah, you are right. So actually,
is the formula or size slave boson in condition?
Sorry, this F is the Schrödinger fermion. Yeah, Z is this rotor. And in fact, this construction allows a SU2 gauge symmetry, but that's a gauge symmetry spoken.
What's the on-site constraint?
The on-site constraint is implemented by this basically gauge fluctuation. Yeah, those are technical details. Yeah, so I can explain this to you later. So I just want to give some general understanding about this magic. The point is, okay, so we already have this spin-on charge on the U1 gauge field, and we actually need two type of charge-ons. One carry electric plus one, another carry electric minus one, because we want to describe both particle hole excitations. Okay, so I want to describe this transition in my slave rotor theory, so I need to describe these two phases. So what are these two phases? So here you can understand the importance of the Poynting-Smith-Hall physics. The magnetic order phase is described by the Z boson are fully gapped, and spin-on actually form this Poynting-Smith-Hall background. The spin-on is a Poynting-Smith-Hall insulator. But because it's coupled to the U1 gauge field, the gauge field is gonna fluctuate. There's a photon mode. But what Poynting-Smith-Hall physics tells you is that the photon is actually a Goldstone mode.
I understand this. So Goldstone mode, we know how to understand it as a coset, right? Your original symmetry and the resulting symmetry. The number, how many branches of Goldstone mode. Does it match the photon that's only one, there's no longitudinal and transverse?
Yeah, but also only one photon mode here. Goldstone mode. You know,
picture, right? Photon just the Goldstone mode of the condensate of the flux.
Yeah, so the picture is the following. You imagine your photon fluctuate. What that means is, let's say I take the magnetic field picture. The magnetic field gonna, there's some slow fluctuation. It's a large here, small here, large here, small here. And Poynting-Smith-Hall physics tells you that the magnetic field is bound to the spin density. Right? So if I insert some magnetic field, it accumulates upspin and deplete downspin. So it's basically flip spin. Right? So the magnetic field fluctuation is the spin density wave. It's basically the Goldstone mode. Yeah, so.
So you are basically spin is gapped and the gauge boson is one massless gauge boson you have. So
right.
In two dimensional case, it will be confined.
It's actually a Coulomb phase. The reason is simply because the monopoles are not allowed. You're probably talking about this monopole induced confinement. But here, the monopole actually flips spin, which is not allowed by macroscopic symmetry.
Microscopic symmetry.
Yeah, symmetry. And microscopic symmetry have this spin conservation, right?
So that restriction is come from the you originally choose the quantum spin or wave function.
What do you mean?
So you basically apply the projection onto the quantum spin or wave function.
Right.
And since you have some start from the time reversal symmetric wave function.
Okay, so basically I try to describe some phase in some microscopic model. That microscopic model have the spin conservation symmetry and charge conservation symmetry. That's it. Yeah. Okay. So
Can I understand in this way? So that's related to my earlier questions. Yeah. So if I look at the quantum spin hall, then it's totally gapped. And if I do the Gauss-Weiler projection, then I get the gapless modes.
Yeah.
And that Gauss-Weiler projection is represented by the gauge boson, so that
exactly. So in fact, you can ask what is the magnetic order pattern on the magnetic side. So you can do the Gauss-Weiler projection. It turned out to be able to compute the magnetic order pattern exactly in the thermodynamic limit. So actually, this is a pretty cool result. You really know the magnetic order pattern by computing the modulable quantum number. But let's forget all this technical detail. The other phase is superconductivity. That phase is described by Z1, Z2 boson are both condensed. And in this phase, the U1 gauge field is Higgs out. But you are left with a charge conservation breaking because this guy is non-zero, this guy is a gate neutral, but carry electron 2 because Z1 is a positive electric charge, Z2 negative electric charge, so this guy is a charge 2, so really cooler pair. So the phase transition, I mean, by looking at this, we already have the Lorentz theory for this phase transition. So it turned out to be this Z1, Z2 boson condensation when coupled to a fluctuating E1 gauge field. So this is a so-called pretty well-known easy plane case of NCCP1 model. And in fact, if you think about it, this Z1, Z2 are all physical. Those are simply the antiferromagnetic vortices which carry electric charge. Because those carry a gauge charge, they're going to interact with the log interaction, which is nothing but the interaction between two vortices. And those guys carry charge. Okay, so then we have the phase diagram. So my claim is you can go from the antiferromagnetic insulator to superconductor through a second order transition. This axis is decreasing the Hubbard U. This axis is by doping. So the claim is with the symmetries, you have a DR transition without fine-tuning.
How the model at how fitting, even your deepest low slope at insulating state? So let's set a chemical.
Yeah, so this is a schematic. So we don't really have a microscopic model which I simulated and show you there's a transition. So I think what you really want is a microscopic model and then simulate it and I show you that phase. That's not that. It's not.
How can we have this pairing phase with purely repulsive
view? That's I think many people believe there's such a phase.
Here I don't see a very clear picture. Right?
Yeah, but maybe let's chat a little bit later. No, I don't have much time. So
what
here.
What's the nature of the critical point?
Oh, the NCCP1. I told you here. So this is a Lorentz theory for the transition.
Yeah, we'll have to write down the Lagrangian to explain to people.
Yeah, basically it's a boson coupled to gauge field and boson condensed. Higgs out the gauge field. That's it. Yeah, it's a the universality of the transition is important, but I think the beauty of this theory is really to predict. The symmetry of these two set of phases, right? And that's maybe even more more sharp.
So this compared to the SO5 theory, so what's the difference then in the
I'm not very familiar with SO5.
But actually, the non-ED plane, the SU2 invariant CP1 model has been conjectured to have the SO5 symmetry. In that sense, actually very closely related to the SO5 proposal, Su Chen had before.
Yeah.
The delta ISO file is also between the magnetic ultra and the supernatural.
No, not between something. Well, I'm just saying the.
Okay, at least I can say one thing.
So if I want to say there's some ISO 5 here, then the 5 component would be the following: the 2 easy plane magnetic ultra nail, and this is a superconductor. There are two superconductor components. And the fifth component is the quantum spin hall. It's not the nail order in the z direction. It's the quantum spin hall in the z direction. So that's maybe at least one difference.
So I think in working with five theory, the transition is just five,
you know,
described by lambda
gives 0.5.
Here, I think
it's. Yeah, basically, there's a funny barrier phase. I can explain it in a little bit detail, hopefully. So let's go further a little bit. What I'm doing was on square lattice. I can play the same thing on honeycomb lattice. Then I predict any Fermat order to every superconductor transition. So that means if I have any Fermat order on the honeycomb lattice, then the natural superconductivity close to this order gonna be FF. So that's a prediction. It's a pretty cool thing. You can do it in a general case. Okay, so here is why the sigma model is special. I have this theory, and I compare with another theory which can predict this direct transition. This is called the Wiese-Mitten-Witten theory by this Santo and Fischer. I think Fischer is not around. So what this theory tells you is to predict a transition between competing orders. So what you need to do is to put all these orders together and form a nonlinear sigma model. And then you ask yourself whether that nonlinear sigma model have a particular barrier phase, which is the Wiese-Mitten-Witten term. And if you have such a term, then it means there's such a direct transition. It's basically these two orders are competing.
Does that mean if I if I take your model with the nearest order and the superconductivity, and the fifth one you said is quantum spin hall?
Yeah, you have this term.
You integrate the formula, you get this model.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing here. So I want to compare with this theory. I do exactly what you were saying. And I start from Dirac limit, and I put in these orders as mass terms, and I integrate a fermion, and I found a Wiese-Mitten-Witten term.
And the transition should be the same as that NPN.
Yeah. But there's a quantum spin hall and the nail are not related, so you expect some easy plane and anisotropy. So then you go to this easy plane of NCCP one. So that means our theory and this theory are consistent. So what's the new thing then? So the difference is the slip-rotor theory that I'm talking about is only for magnetic superconductor transition. The Wiese-Mitten-Witten term can be more general. But on the other hand, our theory can describe coplanar order, so meaning non-collinear. Okay. But the non-collinear order, I think, is pretty difficult for this Wiese-Mitten-Witten theory, at least on this level. I don't know whether it's possible or impossible. At least on this level, what people do is you add mass terms. But the mass terms you can add on, in generically going to be collinear. Because that, if you want to describe magnetic order phase, you have some sigma. Right? You only have one sigma. That's collinear.
It's also possible, right? If you have this kind of non-collinear order, it means that the order parameter manifold changes to S3, not to S2.
Yeah, basically, you have to ask this question, whether you can write down mass terms, which give you Wiese-Mitten-Witten terms, but also have a coplanar order. Basically, I think it's impossible. So basically, our theory is more general to describe this superconductor and magnet transition. So here's my last slide. I'm working on this triangle lattice, motivated by this organic compound. This one is really a bandwidth-driven transition. And have the interplay of magnet and the superconductivity. So one can say something unbiased for this guy. So what is superconductivity? Okay. And thank you very much.
So
So if we simplify a model, go to one dimension, actually you can easily write a personalization version, say you have two different type cosine terms, right? They are dual field, and they are competing that which ones dominate depends on the Laplacian parameter. And I think that probably all the story can have some much easier understandable version than
the... Yeah, in fact, the window-winding term can be written for the one plus one D.
That kind of term in the personalization, you can't explicitly say it, but...
No. If you have spin pool, you can do the
non-abelian
position. Yeah.
But I mean, just for simplest case, say, you have charge density wave competed with superconductivity, and you have two different kind of cosine terms, one is cosine theta and another
but
cosine phi.
It's not going to happen at this kind of form,
should be,
right?
Because theta and phi are dual variables.
Yeah.
So the same story will happen there, and you get some direct transition from
CDW to S.
To superconductor or either.
Yeah, but CDW to superconductor duality is known even.
Well, maybe you should stop that afterwards if there's any questions for the speaker.
Yeah, so another question is, if you do the Gauss Weather projection on the open boundary system, then before projection, I know there are edge states, not Carroll. There are edge states, and you calculate the correlations, they are parallel. And when you do projection, is there something left on the edge?
Yeah, so, okay, for your question, I can answer in the following way. So, in fact, I compute this magnetic order pattern, this magnetic correlation function. What I found is, if you do the Gauss Weather projection, at short range, you have a strongly enhanced magnetic order pattern. But on the long range, it's parallel, actually. So it's actually quite non-trivial. So it means this Gauss Weather projection really don't give you the exactly right long range physics. So for example, on this honeycomb lattice, it's basically a K-Malley model, right?
Yes.
And then if you you have a, suppose I don't have the mass, it's simply graphene, right? So then I can do a Gauss Weather projection. Then I can measure a spin correlation function. So this guy scale like 1/r, 1.89. Okay, so then I turn on the mass, the K-Malley mass, right? So that I know it's, the noisy theory should give you a long range order. But if you measure that, you find it's a 1/r, 1.00. Right? So you know it's enhanced, but not that enhanced. Actually, that's why I do this thing. I do this monoball calculation. So you see, there's some issue here, right? So if you want to, if you want to ask, what's the sharp way? So how do you know it's anti-Fermat order? How do you know? Because both are parallel, so you know it's enhanced, but it's not sharp. So this multiple quantum number calculation is to solve that issue. So basically, the order pattern we know is determined by the multiple quantum number, and that is sharp. You just compute the symmetry of your multiple operator. And that's the symmetry of the mono operator, which is plus minus, and that's anti-Fermat. So that's a sharp way to phrase this problem. Yeah. Okay.
So actually, coming back to Jumping's question, if you partially project, have you done numerics there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There
so
you shouldn't get any magnetic orbit. You have an inverse projector, you can go to the.
Yeah, I think maybe this is related to this power law thing. So what I really mean by projection, okay, let me say it in this way. The projected wave function is simply a mimic of the gauge fluctuation. It captures something, but not capture the true long range thing. So if you want to understand the true long range physics, what you need to do is basically understand the Laplacian theory.
Wait, but does the projected wave function have long range correlations, not parallel? I mean, this is.
No, it's not the long range.
You can answer it. Does it have a magnetic moment?
No, I already answered that here, right? So this is my measurement.
Yeah, this is numerical.
But What do you mean? Do you want to have some exact results?
No, I want to do the same thing that jumping asked, which is partial projections.
Yeah.
Will you see even a magnetic moment in partial projections? Okay.
Yeah, I would say maybe. I don't have a answer for you, but my guess is if you do the soft projection, basically you're gonna have something short ranged, probably some short range magnetic correlation, but not even power law.
But I mean, physically, when you do a soft projection, doesn't it mean that you introduce some gapped charge sectors to the system? Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Then suppose the charge is gapped, then I don't think it's going to, to change anything.
Okay, let me say this way. Nobody understands projective function. it's a numerics, right? So what we want to know is some the information of the low energy theory from the projective function. I think that's the most beautiful thing is here. So you can compute the multiple quantum number by projective wave function exactly. And that's the only thing universal from the projective function. Yeah. So
Well, what's the density of the project as a K change? After you project it, you don't get a half.
It's always half field.
1 minus double occupancy, you get a. It's still half
billion? Yeah, I mean, you also remove the thing. Basically, you are at half billion, you remove all the
dominancy
and the empty sides. And then you have a spin wave function. Yeah.
So let's see a very simplest case. Square light is the Hubbard model. You tune the Hubbard U from positive to negative. You know, when U passes the zero, the transition from anti-ferromagnetism to superconductivity.
Mm-hmm.
So this story has some
Yeah, if you do that, I'm not sure there's a continuous transition. You may need some further repulsion, yeah.
So,
but
maybe we can continue this